Hi, folks. Welcome to a special edition of the Ring of Fire Radio Podcast. I am your host, Sam Cedar. That's right. This week, folks, we are breaking away from our normal radio format to bring you an uninterrupted show that we hope you'll enjoy. Joining us this week, historian, author, and media critic Eric Alterman will join me to discuss why history majors have declined in our university system more than any other degree and why that's contributing to the decline of historical thinking. And Michael Spies from The Trace will join us to discuss his blockbuster piece in the New Yorker magazine explaining why turmoil at the National Rifle Association is coming from within. I want to thank all our new members this week. You are literally the exclusive and single reason we are able to do this show, produce it each week. If you're listening and you haven't become a member, please consider going to rofpodcast.com and signing up. It's literally a couple of dollars a week, and you keep this show trucking along. We're in the midst of figuring out what the future of this show will be, and your membership will help us decide in a way that will keep this show going. You can also find interviews from this show on my YouTube channel, on the Majority Report channel. That is at youtube.com/Sam Cedar. And just hit the Ring of Fire radio playlist. Kicking off the show, folks, students majoring in humanities, especially history, are on the decline. Our next guest has written a piece outlining how the burdening student debt from the high price of university has caused a dramatic decline in historical thinking. Here to discuss his piece in The New Yorker, Eric Alterman. Joining us now, man about town, Dr. Eric Alterman, whose piece in The New Yorker magazine, The Decline of Historical Thinking, appropriately came out in February. So it is in today's media environment, not timely because it's almost 6 weeks ago, but of course it talks about this dynamic. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Except it's like 10 weeks ago.
10 weeks ago. Well, I mean, that's part of maybe why there's been such a decline in historical thinking is that our ability to measure time has also. All right. Well, let's talk about, because maybe it is my own age and, you know, working with people who are younger than I, that makes this seem so pronounced to me. Although I will concede that 25 years ago, I remember having conversations with people who were my age, the age I am now, about the lack of history. And it just seems like it's progressing. First, tell us how we know that the decline of historical, that historical thinking is declining.
Well, this piece had a specific focus, which was the fact that with the exception of the most selective of Ivy League schools, it's not even true of most Ivy League schools, but with the exception of Harvard, actually Yale is the biggest exception, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, I think it's also true of Harvard, although I couldn't say for sure. There's been a fantastic decline in the number of students majoring in history. And yet these other schools, these very top elite schools, have history is booming in those places. And there's a few explanations for it. The most obvious explanation is that young people today, dating back to the 2008 financial crisis, which is the first class to see this, decline beginning would have been the class that were freshmen during that crisis. They don't feel like they have the luxury of studying history, of studying really any humanities, but history being the one that has fallen most pronouncedly. And the people who do, like at Yale, it's because they don't have to worry about getting jobs. They'll get whatever jobs they want because they went to Yale, and it doesn't matter what they study. But everyone else, almost everyone else, is worried right from the get-go, right from the moment they get their high school diploma, about making their college education pay. And as a result, history departments are in decline everywhere. There's one of the University of Wisconsin campuses did away with its history department entirely, and nobody really knows what to do about it. There are things that could be done, but it's hard to say to people, don't worry about your future. Everybody's worried about their future. So this is a manifestation, I think, of the economic insecurity that is touching just about everyone.
So, all right, so that raises 2 points. One is that history as an academic discipline could be a canary in the coal mine for a whole host of academic pursuits that may not be seen as economically viable. And then two, and maybe we should take the second one first, is that there's something about our culture in our society today that would make history that canary, as opposed to, I don't know, some other academic discipline that may be perceived as having more value just intrinsically? Or what do you think about that second point?
Well, I think those 2 points are inextricably linked. There's no question that, as I said, a lot of students are worried about their future and looking to do things that are seen as giving a better bang for your buck in terms of tuition. But it's also true that universities are doing great in terms of raising money in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and basically not interested in trying to raise money for the humanities, which is much, much more difficult. Stanford is and MIT are the models in this regard. They are getting billions and billions of dollars, and these partnerships that they're creating with their faculty and their graduate students are paying off in returning investments that these schools get a piece of. And you know, if David Blight has just gotten the Pulitzer Prize, a Yale historian, for his biography of Frederick Douglass, among other prizes, Yale's not going to make any money from that. So students will still, there's some students who will still want to study with well-known historians who are famous and write bestsellers. But actually, the historical profession, like most humanities, has gotten increasingly specialized, and most people don't understand what's going on in there. So on the one hand, all humanities faculty has grown into its own vernacular and specialty and become less and less interested in public discourse. And on the other hand, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, has eaten up the budgets of these schools because it's profitable. And it's profitable for the schools themselves, and it's profitable for the students to study it. So history really only has what going for it if you happen to be interested in history. Now, personally, I think that's a tragedy. I majored in history. I have a PhD in history. And I don't think you can understand the world without history. I think, Donald Trump, one of his great successes is that he's told over 10,000 lies as president, but most people don't know which are the lies and which are the truth because Trump will say anything at all without regard to whether or not it's true, and most people are not able to judge. Well, and this has been a problem. You and I have talked about this over time. This was a problem with the Republican Party in particular long before Trump, and with the whole structure that supports the lies of the Republican Party, Fox News and Breitbart and Alex Jones and all those crazy people. But it's becoming something that is it's reaching a kind of tipping point in our public discourse, kind of the way global warming is reaching a tipping point, that the public discourse is so filled with nonsense, and much of it is ahistorical nonsense, that there's no way to swim in it anymore. There's no way to get back to truth.
All right. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about that tipping point and what that means. But I just want to just go back for a moment when you say that history departments and history as a discipline is becoming more insular and has no interest in or has a diminished interest in public discourse. What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't want to state this too broadly because there are a lot of historians who have taken up the challenge of trying to bring history to the public. There's a group of Twitter historians, one in particular named Kevin Cruz, has gotten kind of famous here. Hundreds of thousands, or a lot of followers, tens of thousands of followers. He's always beating up Dinesh D'Souza, who's always lying. And there are others who saw the problem and have been using Twitter and social media to try and address it. There's a group of people who I think even crooks and liars.
Yep.
So it's not 100% true. But by and large, if you want to succeed, if you want to get tenure, which is getting harder and harder to get, you have to write a very specialized kind of work. And it's not the kind of work that most people would be able to just pick up and read, because it's written in, of course, specialized language. It's a conversation with other historians who have done similar kinds of research, and it's not history written for a broad public. And those historians who do write for a broad public are generally not respected by other historians. So it's been a problem, and this is true of English professors, of sociologists, of anthropologists. It's not only true of history, but history was always something that people understood to be something that everyone should know. And now that's not the case. Now everyone should know economics and coding, I guess, but not necessarily history. So the numbers of who go to college to get a broad education have gone way, way down.
Is that dynamic a function of almost like an acceleration, do you think? And this is maybe a slightly outside of your portfolio, but you are a thinker of many things, and you've seen exactly. Do you think that dynamic has always happened in academia, where you have the institutions of various disciplines impose their standards on the next generation that come up, and you know, sometimes that's more problematic than others. Now it seems particularly problematic, and I wonder if that isn't a function of the speed in which information is coming at us, and it creating a sort of a wider generational rift than time obviously hasn't changed, but the amount of information and events that pass through that time has increased. I mean, do you think that because of that, institutions are sort of at this moment less apt in terms of keeping up with the times?
I don't know. I wouldn't say that's the case. I mean, historians, they do what they do. They revise history. They do research and find new information and recast it and rethink it. And it's complicated business. History is very complicated.
But I'm saying in terms of where the rewards. So like someone like Kevin Cruz, who is, bringing history to the masses through Twitter, may be disincentivized by, I'm talking a Kevin Cruz type of guy, let's just say, would not, what he's doing, though it is a valuable asset to history as a discipline and to society, is not valued by the history establishment. And I wonder if that
always been thus. It's always been thus. What's different now is that all the money is going into STEM and not into humanities and not into history. And tenure is disappearing. So that now the majority of students in American universities are taught by non-tenured faculty. And that's getting worse. So the people who are the academic proletariat that have to teach seven classes, right now I teach at CUNY. I'm a professor at CUNY, and the union is fighting to try and get adjunct faculty $7,000 per class, which is not very much money at all. And they're not getting it. Right now, I think they get under $4,000. So just to make $50,000 a year, they have to teach 12 classes. classes a year. That's a lot of classes. That's a, and they're not in the same place. You have to travel from class to class. You know, these are often two or three times a week. So they have no time to do historical research. They're just trying to, you know, they're just trying to feed themselves and clothe themselves. Some of these people end up living in their cars. So there is an enormous inequality in academia. And the jobs are like, you know, throwing a little bit of bread into a pond of starving fish. And at the meantime, STEM faculties are growing, and there's all kinds of economic opportunities if you're in that field to branch out with various companies and research monies and so forth. And it's just a lot more attractive to everyone. So history departments, which were very fat for a while, I mean, prosperous for a while, like after beginning with in the 60s, when Sputnik happened and we felt like we had to broaden our educational base and our knowledge, and history was understood that something was something everybody had to know, that feeling is gone now. And now everything, including college education, is seen as a hustle. And there's very little point in hustling in history because the jobs are not there, either for potential faculty or for students who study it, unless, again, you're at the very top of the elite school.
Have we ever, I mean, is this unprecedented? Like the sort of the, I mean, because let's assume this continues, right? And to a certain extent, it seems to me to be a cycle, like a spiraling down, right? I mean, it's hard to imagine a scenario, at least, it's hard for me to imagine a scenario where this changes, unless maybe we do have, like, let's say, I don't know, student debt jubilees and, you know, broad-based free college where there's a less of a risk in investing in an education that is not as guaranteed to be profitable, you know, at its on its face. But yeah. Presuming we head down...
My readers, this piece got more reaction than anything I've written in many years, and a lot of people were trying to figure out what was to be done about it. Somebody came up with the idea, which I thought was a great idea, was to reduce tuition for students who major in humanities classes, particularly history, because the debt burden is part of what they're concerned about,
right.
And that's why they don't get to choose it. But, you know, Sam, it's quite similar to what's happening in the media, that the mainstream media are being hollowed out, particularly at the local level, but everywhere. And we're getting enormous inequality of information. So that if you are a well-to-do person and you can pay for you know, lots of different kinds of sources and specialized sources, you're going to know more than any human being has ever known in the past because there's so much information available to you. But if you're not, if you're just a harried person who gets news on the catch as catch can basis, or if you're not even aware of these sources because you're basically getting your news from Facebook and your friends, then you're going to be the kind of person who's very susceptible to demagogues like Donald Trump and Trumpets. And it seems to me that our educational system is mirroring that hollowing out, that it's serving the very, very top beautifully, and everybody else is kind of on their own. And it's creating, well, it's contributing to this enormous distinction in our society. I wouldn't say it's a 1% and a 99%. I think it's more like a 10% and a 90% society.
So let's talk about this dystopia that we're headed into. And even, you know, with the absence of historical thinking, you don't have to divorce it from the media. But I imagine, I mean, what, I mean, is it, do we have a precedent for something like this in modern times where, you know.
The problem has always been there. I quote, as I often do, Walter Lippmann from the 1920s. Saying that if we're not careful, democracy can easily be taken over by the terrorists, the jingo, and the charlatan, because those are the people who are best able to manipulate the public. And that's why it's so important to, I mean, Lippmann saw himself as a gatekeeper to protect the public from that. Now, we've had gatekeepers in the past, and they did a lousy job in a lot of ways, but without gatekeepers, things turn out to be much worse. Nobody understood that till we saw first, you know, the internet and then social media with followed on it, and the enormous amount of nonsense and deliberate misinformation that has flooded the system. So a history degree is a hedge against that nonsense. You can read Breitbart. I mean, if you take Kevin Cruz, the example of Kevin Cruz's argument with Dinesh D'Souza over whether or not the Democrats are the party of racism compared to Republicans, if you knew any history, you wouldn't have to take D'Souza seriously.
Right.
He's a charlatan, and he's pushing an ideological line designed to support Trump's racist policies. Kevin conducted a kind of mini seminar on Twitter for people who had no knowledge of that. But there's literally thousands of those kinds of issues. Like one thing I mentioned, there's no question that if you look at immigration and the history of the United States, it's been a fantastic thing. You know, it's one of the reasons we became it is probably the main reason that in our natural resources, well, we became the wealthiest nation in the world in so short a time, back in the 1890s. We are smiting ourselves by destroying a pipeline of people wanting to come here and study here and open a business here and so forth. And that's the most obvious thing if you studied any American history at all. But if you don't know that, then you're subject to Trump's lies and racist attacks on people who look different and speak different and can be blamed for your problems.
Well, I guess we're going to see how far down the sort of the dystopian hole we can go, I guess. I mean, is there a way to end this?
You know, every week I teach old people for the Jewish Agency for Services to the Aged every Sunday morning for an hour, current events. And they always say, this is the last week of the semester. And they always say, say something optimistic, Eric. Don't leave us like this. And I never can.
Well, I guess thank you for that, Eric. Hopefully, I mean, at the very least, we have clarified one of the many challenges that we face. And I don't know. I mean, I guess people should follow you and Kevin Cruz on Twitter.
Yeah, more Kevin than me.
All right. Fair enough.
My next book will be a history of presidential lying from George Washington to Donald Trump. Called Lying in State. I'm writing the end of it. I came upstairs to get on the phone and put it down, but I'm almost done with it. And I hope to show that we're in a much different, even though presidents have lied forever, if you look at history, you can see that we're in a much different situation than we've ever been in before.
Well, I look forward to that, and we'll have you back when that book is out. Eric Alterman, thanks so much for your time today.
Always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Eric Alterman is a history professor, author, and media critic. You can read his piece, The Decline of Historical Thinking, over at the New Yorker magazine. The NRA has attributed a lack of funding to left-wing attacks on the Second Amendment, but in a new expose by our next guest, the real problem may be coming from inside the organization. Here to discuss, journalist Michael Spies. Welcome to the program, Mike, and I will say, on this very week, there have been new revelations, leaked letters that suggest that Wayne LaPierre has been living very, very large. He, of course, is the executive director, is that it, of the NRA?
He's the executive vice president and CEO of the NRA, yeah.
So let's backtrack, and we'll circle back around to LaPierre's excessive spending, because this sort of your work points to some extent where the money is coming from and how it's being spent. But one of the things I found shocking about your piece is that the NRA has been in financial trouble for what seems like multiple decades.
Yeah, and for generally the same reason, which is that it's been under Wayne LaPierre's leadership, it's been engaging in endless profligate spending, mostly for the purpose of self-dealing enrichment for a few, like a small group of vendors, contractors, senior management officials, folks that have ultimately over the last few decades extracted hundreds of millions of dollars from the organization's coffers.
And all right, so let's walk through this. Like, how has this taken place? I mean, where did the things start going off the track? And I guess, like, I mean, I remember in the early 90s when George Herbert Walker Bush publicly resigned from the NRA, largely because of Wayne LaPierre. I mean, what is that around the time that the organization changed?
Well, he did resign from Wayne LaPierre because of Wayne LaPierre because of a fundraising letter that he signed, which was, of course, created by one of the NRA's vendors. And I believe that vendor was a firm that has morphed now into different entities that are still paid by the NRA, and that firm is called PM Direct. And yes, it was around that time. Wayne LaPierre ascended to the NRA's top post in 1991. And it seems like that was when the business started to go sideways. Board members themselves started to get sort of caught into the problems, you know, within the first 5 years of his leadership. You could see in board minutes we obtained from that period that they were admitting very frankly that they were, even at that time in 1996, in deep financial trouble. They'd been insolvent for a number of years. They were overly leveraged. And one of the major problems was that they were just unable, frankly, to rein in Wayne's spending. And much of Wayne LaPierre's spending was going toward public relations, ultimately promoting him and building his image and that sort of thing. And they were specifically calling out a firm that's been involved with the NRA's business for going back to the early 80s, but took on a far more prominent role once Wayne became the top leader.
All right. Well, let's talk about that history because it's fascinating, and it also, like, I mean, let's go through the history, and then I want to maybe just get your assessment to the extent that you feel comfortable. I mean, I know you report on this stuff, so what you're talking about is stuff that you have found either documentary or sort of through interviews. But I'm just sort of there does feel like there's a part of the story that's sort of missing as of yet. I mean, Wayne LaPierre is spending all this money ostensibly promoting himself, but within an agency that he's staying in, right? Like, it's, you know, so if you're threatening the solvency of that vehicle in a way to promote yourself, even though you're staying in that vehicle, there's some other dynamic maybe that's going on. But before we get there, where did this dynamic of this, what appears to be on some level, some measure of self-dealing, where did that start?
Well, I mean, I can at least only speak to, again, charting back to the rise of LaPierre to the NRA's top post. And I think, you know, what we're getting at right now is the NRA's fundamental relationship, the relationship that built the modern NRA, and that is its relationship with this firm, Ackerman McQueen, that became crucial for Wayne LaPierre. It essentially, I mean, Wayne, by anyone's description who knows him, is not just mild-mannered. People call him meek, serious introvert. He is not the person that you encounter in public. And the NRA, of course, had aspirations to become this very strong national organization, putting itself on the front lines of an issue that it ultimately created, that of gun rights. So it needed to professionalize its messaging. It brings on this PR firm, Ackerman McQueen. Ackerman essentially concocts Wayne LaPierre's persona out of whole cloth. And over time, the firm and the organization have become sort of inextricably intertwined. Now, I hesitate. That means, among other things, that there's you know, been quite literally a revolving door between the two places. Executives that worked at one now work at the other, and vice versa. Internal documents that I obtained specifically say that roughly 25% of the NRA staff are managed by former Ackerman McQueen personnel. there's just been an incredible exchange of money. That being said, what has sort of happened over time is the blame has been placed on the firm itself, which is not quite right. I mean, the firm is doing what the firm is supposed to do, which is to make a profit and as much profit as it can, and it's doing this off of a client. Now, the issue is, of course, the willing client that has that bought into this relationship and ultimately allowed it to become what it is, which is sort of the apparatus that produces the vast majority of the organization's messaging. So, you know, as I've said before, when you, the average person, are encountering the NRA, or you believe you are in media, you're really encountering this firm. And that, you know, means Dana Loesch, Colleen Noir, any of the leading personalities. These are folks who are Ackerman McQueen people. NRA TV, Ackerman McQueen produced, conceived, and this is, I'm just talking about, you know, the current moment, but some of the most famous ad campaigns you know of, going back to the period you're talking about, the 90s, the I'm the NRA campaign, I mean, that's also an Ackerman McQueen creation. So you have people, you have executives at the NRA who also have stakes in Ackerman-related entities. You're talking about where the self-dealing starts. That's some of it, but it extends far beyond that. You have a number of people that have a number of conflicts of interest with, you know, a series of firms that the NRA pays money to.
Okay, so all right, and so there's. There's almost like two major, I guess, silos of issues, right? From the perspective, at the very least, of critics of the NRA. One is sort of the problem with the substance of their work, which you touched on in part, was the sort of the creation of this mentality around gun rights, which they have now extended to a sort of virulent form of social conservatism that doesn't really have much to do with gun rights necessarily, but is, I guess, sort of an expansion of the things that are theoretically on the table for the tribe around gun rights. And then there's also sort of the operations of the entity, which there's multiple issues there, and you've done work in the past in terms of their relationship to electioneering, but that there may be some self-dealing. So let's start on that sort of or continue on that sort of operations, because the whole issue is not so much that, I mean, I don't think it's that strange for an organization to have a PR firm. The question is, what is the nature of that relationship? Because we have an entity that takes tax-free contributions, right? That is theoretically supposed to be geared towards promoting. Well, what you tell us, their charter, in terms of the way they're chartered with the IRS, what are they supposed to be doing?
Well, they're supposed to, it's called the 501c4 under the tax code. They're tax exempt, and under the tax code, they keep their tax exempt status by promoting social welfare. Nobody is supposed to get rich off of a nonprofit. So that is one of the fundamental issues. Certainly nothing wrong. And again, I don't want to make this too much about the PR firm, because it's one thing, but it's the NRA's problem. It's not the firm's problem. The firm's job is to get the business that it can get. The issue is just the amount of money that gets moved from the nonprofit to that firm, and along with many others, or a small handful of others. So in 2017 alone is the figure that many have heard right now. The money that, you know, some 12% of the NRA's total expenses went to that one firm. That came to more than $40 million. So that becomes the issue. Is a nonprofit, should it be operating as almost like a pass-through entity for other for-profit entities or people? I mean, to move off of that. You know, there are these folks who worked in senior management for a number of years at the NRA. They leave, but then they end up staying on as consultants. And I say consultants with quotes, because it's just what they do is not really clear. But they get paid many hundreds of thousands of dollars every year. Those are just people, so just individuals. There are executives who are, you know, who are getting contracts for their dads, their wife, you know, like they're connected, you know, getting making payments to firms that employ their wives, hiring former friends from other problematic businesses. Like it just there's an endless number of these issues, and in the you know what the documents that we have show is that all the main problem, perhaps, is that so much of this. These problematic transactions are in many ways being disguised from the NRA's own accountants. Like they're the ones who have produced these memos that I've obtained, and what they started in earnest sounding the alarms about last summer were, you know, we're paying, like, for example, $1.8 million for quote unquote rental of a house from that belongs to the owner of a business that we contract with. We have no idea why we've done that. And this is just one example of many examples, you know, where this keeps on playing out. And we're in this terrible financial state right now. And what the documents seem to say and what the accounts are saying is we've driven ourselves here. We've created this by making it this situation in which we're kind of almost operating as a piggy bank that we've allowed people just to sort of willy-nilly put their hands in and take money out of.
And just to be clear, it's the nonprofit which collects the money tax-free
right.
is, in many respects, managed by the same people who end up being the private entities who are outside of the nonprofit who get paid. So it's not necessarily double-dipping going on, but at least temporally, no double-dipping,
well,
right?
In some cases, it is double dipping. I mean, you have someone who, for example, in 2016, this particular person was managing the NRA's affinity relationships. So that means, you know, the NRA lends its brand to a number of products, different kinds of insurance products, that kind of thing, and then they get paid like a royalty fee through that. And one of the insurance brokers it worked with is called Lockton Affinity to carry out those relationships. Just to give you an example, I mean this particular person retired at the end of 2015. This person then stayed on a couple weeks into 2016 in order to collect a base salary for like $28,000. The reason for doing that is that it would then, because the person in theory had been employed at all during that year, it would allow that person then to collect a bonus from the NRA, which was worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. And at the same time, and the accounts didn't know this, that person was also collecting hundreds of thousands of dollars in payments from Lockton, the vendor that was working with the NRA on those affinity relationships. So, double dipping. And there are... You know, like you said, that's just one illustration.
And so, and I want to talk about that those type of insurances, like CarryGuard, for instance,
right.
in a moment. But, I mean, how does someone like that individual? Is it possible for an individual like that to operate in that way in a rogue fashion? In other words, like
yeah.
you say, like the accountants don't know this stuff,
right.
But you know. And I've worked in some companies where there does seem to be sort of a quiet understanding of people looking around going like, I'm not going to say anything if you don't say anything. And there's I don't know how,
right.
What's your sense of that?
Well, no, the sense is that this is not, I mean, it's, you know, we've enumerated a number of examples that show this kind of thing, and that's really where the story is an accretion of details. But what the documents show, and these are a vast collection of both public and private documents, is that this is a purely systemic issue. This is an institutional problem. And the institutional problem is that this is an institution that's marked by secrecy, self-dealing, and greed. And all of these various arrangements, whether they be conflicts of interest or other payouts, lavish pay packages, bloated pay packages, gratuitous payments, it's all part of the same problem. It happens because it seems like people have just sort of accepted the idea that this is acceptable corporate behavior.
And it seems to me that the implications for society are that what appears to be ideologically motivated is really just sort of a money grab, and they're creating, it's almost as if they're creating markets, you know, like an ideological market based upon just because they're making money off it. I mean, it's a grift.
Well, that is over time what it starts to look like. I mean, I have to obviously be careful, and I can't personally make any kind of declaration like that, but certainly, yeah, I mean, it raises the most important questions, which is what you're getting at. And those are, or maybe that is, maybe just one question is, you know, is this organization really about creating a movement, whatever you take the gun rights movement to mean, you know, whatever that means to you, is that really its central purpose, or is really the purpose of creating a movement to enrich a small group of people, specifically vendors, contractors, senior management folks, or really just folks, senior management and people who have a relationship with senior management. And obviously that is highly problematic for all the obvious reasons. One, the NRA is a tax-exempt and therefore tax-subsidized organization. So all of us American taxpayers are subsidizing the NRA just like we subsidize all 501c4s. And then it is an organization that has a very outsized influence on our politics, particularly an issue that is a matter of life and death, right? I mean, this is something that touches all of our lives in some way or other. And it's sort of almost unthinkable to imagine that all of this carnage and bloodshed has really not been about ideology. It's been about making money. And that is the way it starts to feel the more paper you accumulate.
Tell us about CarryGuard, because that seems to be an exemplar of a product that was sort of almost created out of an ideological movement in some way, right? And that doesn't necessarily serve any purpose other than enriching the people who sell it.
Right. I mean, you know, so I guess to speak to that, to define it first, CarryGuard has two facets. And the first one, which I'll talk about, is the one that really matters. And that is it's a program that provides insurance or self-defense insurance for people who in theory, it's supposed to cover your legal costs in a criminal proceeding in the event that you shoot someone and claim self-defense. So, obviously, to most people, that is just on its face objectionable. You know, the idea that you would, you know, that's why it's been dubbed by activist groups as murder insurance, which is not, you know, it's not a perfectly accurate characterization, but it's certainly close enough that it works and it makes sense. I mean, the idea that you could go out and purchase insurance in advance of shooting someone is obviously not something that any regulators want for the incentives alone. And
right.
So quite obviously, so that product launched, you know, was conceived around the 2016 election, and it became much more important after Trump won, because one, the NRA had already been in a deep financial hole, but then spent way more than it had on the 2016 elections, more than $50 million, a good portion of that in the service of electing Trump, but not all of it. So Trump gets elected. That means that they're not going to be able to fundraise off of a Democratic president who's going to take your guns away, right? That's a big problem. That changes changes everything. It's the exact opposite of what you had in Barack Obama, who became a very convenient, you know, boogeyman. So CarryGuard internally was marketed as a way to sort of safeguard the NRA's financial future and place it on a new path to prosperity.
It's a hedge, right? I mean, it's a perfect hedge.
Right.
If we don't have somebody who's going to take away our guns, we can market the fact that we're going to have the more freedom to kill people in self-defense.
Right.
And
right. Well, we've also, okay. Yeah. That's right. No, you're totally right. It also is – there's in your Perfect Edge, it's also very much part of very vertical integration, right? The NRA created the Stand Your Ground philosophy. So it's also telling its people, if you accept the idea that Stand Your Ground is legitimate and you're going to get into the situation where you may need to have to use your gun in self-defense, you don't want to also then be – you don't want to be depleted by legal costs. So here's this
right.
product. You know, you've satisfied both ends of the market. You've created a demand, and now you're going to satisfy the demand. In theory, that's how it's supposed to work. Of course, there were a number of folks within the organization who said this is a horrible idea. It is not going to stand up to scrutiny, and we shouldn't do it. And according to documents, those people were, quote, unquote, intimidated into silence. So product goes to market in April of 2017, and almost immediately, within a few months, not only gets just slammed by activists across the country and because they were so aggressively marketing the product, but immediately falls under the regulatory scrutiny of the state of New York, and which found last spring, or I guess now two springs ago, in May of 2018, that it obviously broke several New York rules, and which meant that it could not be sold here. And New York is the most important insurance market in the country. It also sort of sets the standard for guidelines and regulations. So a number of states have very similar, if not the same, guidelines and regulations. And that basically meant, well, if it's not going to work in New York, it's probably not going to work in a lot of other places too, which has proven to be the case. It's also, you know, been shut down in California and several other states, and I'm sure there are going to be a lot more. So it's been a massive disaster, and it's put the NRA further into a hole, because that program, the amount of money that was spent on promoting it, creating it, everything else, and then of course the litigation, has only and greatly exacerbated the NRA's financial woes.
Would tell us why New York is so prominent. I'm fascinated by this. It has to do with the founding of the NRA and why New York seems to have an outsized influence, not just because of insurance regulation. They sort of function
right.
in the insurance realm like California does with cars. But they have the Attorney General in New York State has even more power because why?
Well, the NRA is chartered in New York. It was founded here after the Civil War, and its purpose, and this is good to remind everybody of, was to seed a culture of marksmanship. It was founded by former Union soldiers who were dismayed that they were so outshot by their Southern counterparts. And so the mission, and it remained this way. The core mission was supposed to be, you know, gun education, safety training, that sort of thing. It's obviously gotten quite far away from that. At any rate, they never left New York. They remained chartered here. They could have. They didn't. And now, because they are chartered in New York, they fall under the regulatory purview of the New York Attorney General, who, since our stories have come out, has opened, not surprisingly, an investigation into the organization's status as a nonprofit here.
And we should say that your earlier work led to complaints that were filed with the FEC. They were ignored. I believe there's a lawsuit that was filed in the past couple of weeks against the FEC for not acting upon these complaints. This week, leaked documents show that Wayne LaPierre has been very liberal, if you will, with the spending. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was a big sort of public rift between Oliver North and Wayne LaPierre. Well, give me your sense of where this is all headed.
I mean, it seems like it's headed toward a complete implosion. I mean, what's happening is just everyone is trying to stay alive. So it's a game of survival now, and factions have been formed, factions that have been, in some ways been forming over a period of time, and each is trying to just take out the other. I mean, Oliver North, who in theory had his own conflict of interest in that he was, while he was president, and I think they were using this against him, he was getting paid by the PR firm we were talking about earlier. The question is that the NRA has since alleged, and I think this was done to push him out, has since alleged that somehow the details of that contract were kept from the organization, which doesn't really make any sense, or at least certainly defies credulity. But one of the leaked things that came out was that the law firm Brewer and Associates, which has been litigating for the NRA and handling a number of things for the organization, has made an incredible. I mean, they've in the 13 or 14 months they've been working for the organization, they've made something like $24 million. And as of currently, and according to those documents, quarter one of 2019, the NRA has been paying the firm more than $97,000 a day.
Wow, that seems.
Just let that sink in. What that means? I mean, that is. I mean, by any standard, that sounds utterly insane. But again, This is like in Q1 of 2019. What these documents say, that firm has been getting paid more than $97,000
sounds,
per day.
Coming from a family of attorneys, just like, you know, the idea of like. There are, even if it's $1,000 an hour per person firm, right? 97 right. hours of man hours a day. You have five. I mean, you'd have to have 10 attorneys working 10 hours a day every day on your case. That sounds like a lot. I suspect that's going to be a focus of a future story. Well, Mike Spees, the piece is in The New Yorker. I can't recommend it enough, and for folks to follow your work there and at The Trace as this evolves, because I have a feeling we're about to, some of this is going to be get rather messy or more messy, I guess, soon. I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael Spees is a staff writer with The Trance. You can read his piece, Secrecy, Self-Dealing, and Greed at the NRA. Over at the New Yorker magazine. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire. I hope you've enjoyed this special edition of Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. Check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. You can head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream or podcast covering all the biggest news stories of the week, as well as long-form interviews. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.